Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Shavuot has a couple of different things about Shavuot, which we'll talk about. Number one, which was mentioned a few weeks back, when we just read the Torah portion regarding the sequences of timing, is Shavuot is a count cycle, the ending of a count, right? It counts, what's the number it count to? 50. So big 50. Shavuot's 50 is broken up into seven sets of seven. 49. So it has, it's the 50, well, of course, also includes 7 times 7, because of course it's 7 days a week, there's 7 weeks, you get 49, and it's the day after, that's 50. Now, when we talked about Leviticus 25, we read about that a few weeks back, it had to do with Jubilee years, and the counting of sevens, and how the Jubilee cycle was pointed out to us. And it was brought up during that discussion that Shavuot counting is similar, so not quite identical, but very similar to the Jubilee counting process of 7 years, 7 days, 7 weeks, you know, and then 7 sets of 7 all go up to 50. Well, that's not coincidental. God doesn't do many things with coincidences. It's done on purpose. So Shavuot and Jubilees are tied together for a reason. We'll discuss some of those reasons today. Not all of them, but some of them. All right, first of all, let's go to Exodus chapter 19. Now, this is strictly a tradition. It is not spelled out in our Torahs anywhere, but tradition states this event of the giving of the Ten Commandments occurred on Shavuot, the very first one. I say tradition because timing-wise, you add up the dates and the times as well as how it describes it here. It probably was, but you can't prove it. But this is what we read, or part of what we read Exodus on this day. In the third month, from the Exodus, the children of Israel from Egypt, on this day they arrived at the wilderness of Sinai. They journeyed from Rephidim and arrived at the wilderness of Sinai and encamped in the wilderness, and Israel encamped there opposite of the mountain. Moses ascended to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "So shall you say the house of Jacob and relate to the children of Israel. You have seen what I did to Egypt. You have borne you on the wings of eagles and brought you to me. And now, if you hearken well to me and observe my covenant, you shall be to me the most beloved treasure of all peoples. For mine is the world. You shall be to me a kingdom of ministers and a holy nation. These are the words you shall speak, the children of Israel." So Moses came down and summoned the elders of the people and put before them all the words the Lord had commanded him. The entire people responded together, saying, "Everything the Lord has spoken, we shall do." Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I come to you in the thickness of the cloud, so the people will hear as I speak to you, and they will also believe in you forever." Moses related the words of the people to the Lord. Exodus 19. I'm starting at verse 10 now. The Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and sanctify them today and tomorrow, and they shall wash their clothing. Let them be prepared for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord shall descend in the sight of the entire people on Mount Sinai. You shall set boundaries to people around about, saying, 'Beware of ascending the mountain or touching its edge. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely die. A hand shall not touch it, for he shall surely be stoned or thrown down. Whether an animal or person, he shall not live. Upon an extended blast shofar, they may ascend the mountain.'" Moses descended from the mountain, the people, and he sanctified the people, and they washed their clothing. He said to the people, "Prepare for after a 3-day period, do not draw near a woman." On the third day, when it was morning, there was thunder and lightning and a heavy cloud in the mountains, at the mountain, and the sound of the shofar was very powerful. the entire people that was in the camp shuddered. Moses brought the people forth from the camp toward God, and they stood at the bottom of the mountain. All the Mount Sinai was smoking because the Lord had descended upon it in the fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of the furnace, and the entire mountain shuddered exceedingly. The sound of the shofar grew continually much stronger. Moses would speak to the Lord, to God, and God would respond to him with a voice. The Lord descended upon the Mount Sinai at the top of the mountain, and the Lord summoned Moses to the top of the mountain. Moses ascended. The Lord said to Moses, "Descend, warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord, to see a multitude of them will fall. Even the Kohanim who approach the Lord should be prepared, lest the Lord burst forth against them." Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot ascend at the Mount Sinai. But you have warned us, saying, 'Bound the mountain and sanctify it.'" The Lord said to him, "Go, descend. Then you shall ascend, and Aaron with you, but the Kohanim, the people, they shall not break through to ascend to the Lord, lest he burst forth against them." So Moses descended the people, and said it to them. God spoke all these statements, saying, "I am the Lord your God, who has taken you out of the land of Egypt, the house of slavery. You shall have not recognize the gods of others in my presence. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of that which is in the heavens above or on the earth below or in the water beneath the earth. You shall not prostrate yourself to them nor worship them. For I am the Lord your God. I am a jealous God who visits the sins of the fathers upon the children to third and fourth generations for my enemies, but who shows kindness for thousands of generations to those who love me and observe my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. The Lord will not absolve anyone who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day and sanctify it. 6 days shall you work and accomplish all your work. But the seventh day is Shabbat, the Lord your God. You shall not do any work. You, your son, your daughter, your slave, your maidservant, your animal, your convert within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. And he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and sanctified it. Honor your father and your mother, so that your days will be lengthened upon the land the Lord your God gives you. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your fellow. You shall not covet your fellow's house. You shall not covet your fellow's wife, his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that belongs to your fellow. The entire people saw the thunder and the flames, the sound of the shofar and the smoky mountain. The people saw and trembled and stood from afar. They said to Moses, "You speak to us, and we shall hear. Let God not speak to us, lest we die." Moses said to the people, do not fear, for it is in order to elevate you as God comes, that the awe of him shall be upon your faces, so you shall not sin. The people stood from afar, and Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. The Lord said to Moses, "So shall you say, the children of Israel, you should have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. You shall not make images of what is with me, gods or silver, gods of gold. You shall not make for yourselves. An altar of earth you shall make for me. You shall slaughter near it your burnt offerings, your peace offerings, your flocks, your herds. Wherever I permit my name to be mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. And when you make for me an altar of stones, not build a hewn stone, you shall raise your sword against it and desecrated it. You shall not ascend my altar on steps, that your nakedness will not be uncovered upon it." So that's our first beginning. That's our step one for Shavuot, Exodus 19 and 20. Any questions so far about what we just read? We're going to move through a few details here. So Exodus 19, as it points out, it says it starts out roughly in the third month, the beginning of the third month, or near the first part of the third month, which corresponds to, traditionally, Shavuot. We're covering this today because this is an important aspect which Messiah did on his Shavuot when he celebrated it many years later. Where some of these pieces are in the Ten Commandments are what he reiterates again later on. So we'll discuss that. Shavuot starts out with obviously instructing us a few basic things. It's instruction of essentially how to live. Ten Commandments essentially are how to live. How to your relationship with one another and your relationship with God, how it's supposed to live and exist. Note, the people have just gone through the Exodus. They went through, obviously, the various weeks, the 7 weeks of counting. And they've been being taught by God and Moses along the way. Every place they had to stop because it was Shabbat. Okay, we can't go out and pick up sticks. We can't go out and kindle flames. We don't go out and collect all the manna out on Shabbat. All these various lessons that people are learning, what those lessons are and how to live them. Well, on Shavuot is the conclusion of a cycle of counting. We'll discuss a little bit today is, what is the purpose of it? What's the purpose of the counting? What are we counting, and what is God counting? Why? What is the reason that Shavuot is here? Didn't they all get saved under the Exodus? They're all clean. They're all happy. They went through the Red Sea. All the people are good. They've learned their ways. They're God's teaching them along the way. Why did God produce or create Shavuot for celebrating? Or what's the reason for it? We'll discuss that as far as why it's here. First of all, with relation to the Ten Commandments and what we just read as far as how to live, this is not an exhaustive, of course. Your entire Torah is exhaustive. This is just the Ten Commandments. The rest, it's all details as far as how to live them. And tie those into the 50 days of counting and the 7 times 7. In Shavuot and the cycle of counting, we have to do a comparison to understand what's going on. What is it that the 7 times 7 weeks and the 50 days have to do with the 7 times 7 years and the 50 years of Jubilee? And why are those two similar? And their similarities explains to us what the counting of 7 weeks of Omer were that we just went through of first fruits, as well as explains to us what Shavuot is about. The Messiah, of course, reiterates this again later, and so does the book of Acts. So up here I have written a few different words. The first few words, and this is not everything we're covering today, but this is the core of it. It discusses, I have written, liberty, restoration, and accepted or acceptance. Shavuot and the 7 sabbatical years and the Jubilee are all based on these ideas. The liberty, restoration, and acceptance. That's the basis of the Jubilee and the 7 years of counting, which also is the same basis of the 7 weeks, the 7 days counting. They're standing on the same foundation. That's the objective. And that's what we're going to talk about today. That's what they do. So, to understand Shavuot, the 7 weeks, we have to understand Jubilee and the 7 years. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 25. Now, I'm not reading the entire book, or entire chapter, just certain highlights of it. Those of you who recall, the 7 years, that the sabbatical year, every 7 years, people get to go free, your slaves go free, you have to give up your debts, the creditors release you of your debts, that's recorded in Deuteronomy. Every 7 years, we're debt-free, all our slaves are free. Well, Israelite slaves are free, believer slaves are free. So in that notion, those 7 weeks, which is recorded in Leviticus 25, it says, of course, in the first part of it, in Leviticus 25, it points out that the Lord said to Moses, saying, when you speak to the children of Israel, when you come to the land, you shall observe the Sabbath rest for the Lord. 6 years you may sow your fields, 6 years you may prune your vineyard, and you may gather its crop. The 7th year should be a complete rest for the land, the Sabbath for the Lord. Your field shall not be sown, your vineyard shall not prune, the aftergrowth of your harvest shall not reap, the grapes you shall set aside, that you had set aside for yourself, you shall not pick. It shall be a year of rest for the land. The Sabbath produce of the land shall be yours to eat, for you, your slave, your male servant, your maidservant, your brother, laborer, your resident who dwells with you, your animal, and all the beasts for your crops shall be food for them. So, in the process of the first we learn, is recorded here, I'm going to change colors here, the 7 years is rest. And what rests? In this case, it's the land. The land rests. Now, we discussed the time we were covering Leviticus 25, was that the land which Adam was made from, and all of us around here are made from, dirt, who was resting spiritually then? Man is resting spiritually. Because if you look at it obviously, when a farmer is farming, is he resting? No. When a farmer is not farming, is he resting? Yes. So who is actually resting? Is it the land or is it the farmer? They both are. The point is that the concept behind it is that the rest happens. and it requires a man not to do the work so the land can rest. So that's what we learn about in the 7 years of the land resting. The same thing happens as we already discussed the time with Shabbat, every 7 days. Who rests? Well, the man rests. Of course, obviously the land rests too. So every 7 days of the week, we learn that the seven has to do with resting. So 7 years, 7 days equals resting. So that's the similarities between Shabbat and the 7 year cycle count. But there's other aspects of the 7 years that is not in Shabbat. And we're going to read about that next. This also, Leviticus 25. Jump down to verse 54, the last few verses. I'm not reading the entire section. This is regarding the man who was a slave or was a slave to you or to one of your slaves. If he has not been redeemed by these various means, we're not reading the entire account, it takes too long. Then he, referring to the slave, shall go out in the year of Jubilee, he and his children with him. For the children are service to me, and they are service to whom I have taken out of the land, I am the Lord your God. In the cycle of the Jubilee period, my marker go. I'm going to erase part of this. I'll draw it back up here in a minute. I'm out of room already. I wrote too big. So in the Jubilee period, which is 7 times 7, plus 1, because it goes 50 years, that's all slaves. Free. However, this is all slaves, every one of them. But every 7 years, your Hebrew slaves have to go free. So 7 years, Hebrew slaves. I use the word Hebrew loosely. That includes everybody who is biologically of the descendants of Israel, as well as all sojourners, which means people who are living with you or dwelling with you who believe. Any residents who say, I wish to follow or throw my hat in the ring, I'm part of the believing God too. All of those groupings, every one of them, goes free every 7 years. The slaves, every 50 years, are all those who are not going to believe in God. Say, your God, I got my own, I'm going to live my life. That's fine, stay a slave 50 years, then you get to free. Yes, Bill.
The Hebrew slaves, when they go free, do they go back to their land?
The land, returning to the land happened every 50 years. So the Hebrew slaves can go free at the 7 year marks. Any slave you acquired before the 7 year mark goes free that day if they are a Hebrew slave. The Jubilee year, everybody goes out. There isn't an exception except there's some land, some housing rules that do happen. That's a different story. So in this process of slaves going free, the Hebrew slaves as well as all slaves, where is that in our 7 days of Shabbat? Sort of, yeah. You're still servant to some degree. You're free for working, but you have to go back in the next day. Free from your boss for a day, but you can go back again on the next day, the following, because you have to go back. You're back into slavery again. The point is, this concept of freedom and a permanent freedom is not written in Shabbat. It's not supposed to be. It's written somewhere else. The concept of resting, which word Shabbat means, is the seven to sleep or to rest or to not work. That's what it's meant, the concept of resting. Man rests, land rests. That's every Shabbat, no difference. The freedom of slaves isn't written in Shabbat. Because slaves go back to work for you the following day. Every Shabbat, you have a Sunday rest. What happens on the following Sunday? Everybody back to work. I don't care if you were a slave Friday, you're still a slave Sunday because you're back to work again. The slaves never go free. In this idea, the 7 years and the 50 years, the slaves go free. That's where first fruits comes in. That's where the concept of the freedom comes in that seven cycle counting. It's not tied in Shabbat, it's tied into the Omer, the counting, the Omer. So now we discuss this, erase part of it, let's go back to my previous diagram. I'm going to leave that part up because it's important. Okay, so now let's discuss this concept. What is freedom? What does it mean to be free? Free from what? Free from whom? Free to do what? What are we free? I mean, they just don't pay any money. Free means there is something you are free from, right?
Sin.
That is one aspect, free from sin. Free from what else? What else can you be free from? So I can hear that. Free from death penalty. All those are parts of being free. And those are aspects which we discuss. In this freedom of slaves every 7 years, and of course the Jubilee on the 50th year, there are certain parts that are being freed. One of the aspects which we'll go to in Leviticus 25, we'll discuss that also. It's recorded in verse 8. This regarding to the 7 years of cycle of how it all rests and how all these men take their time off. And this is the restoration of properties. You shall count for yourselves 7 cycles, sabbatical years. 7 years, 7 times. A year is 7 cycles. A sabbatical year should be for you for 49 years. You shall sound a broken blast, a shofar, in the 7th month, the 10th day of the month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall sound the shofar throughout your land. Sanctify the 50th year, proclaim it freedom throughout the land for all its inhabitants. It should be the year of Jubilee. For you to you shall return each man to his ancestral heritage. You shall return each man to his family. It should be a Jubilee year for you. This 50th year, you shall not sow, not harvest after its aftergrowth. You shall not pick what was set aside of it for yourself. It is a Jubilee year. It should be holy to you. The field you may eat its crop. In this Jubilee year, you shall return each man to his ancestral heritage. To return someone to their ancestral heritage is what? Restoration. To restore something. So we know that in this concept of freedom, there is built in the definition on the 50th year of freedom is a restoration of something. Something's being brought back to wherever it was supposed to be, its original beginning. What gets restored? In this case, every man, I change colors. Okay. Every man, which of course obviously includes his families as well, the man is restored to his ancestral heritage, to his heritage. So all men restored their heritage. What is the heritage? Their land. If they have property in their family, it's restored their family. If they sold or whatever they had to, that's how it's always given back to. So their land is their heritage. But wait a minute. Land has rest. Land equals man, doesn't it? You notice, we wrote up here earlier, we discussed this previously. Land, because Adam is made from dirt, right? Land or dirt equals man. So the man is restored to his heritage, which is dirt. The man's restored to dirt. No, he doesn't die. He's restored to dirt, to his original beginning. What is the true heritage then? That's what we're talking about. Next. The breath of God. That is his heritage. Genesis. Let's go to Genesis. Let's see here. Well, a couple different places, but first chapter 1 is a good place to start. But I think it's also recorded in chapter 2. Let's see, dust the ground. There he is. We'll start in verse 4. Chapter 2 of Genesis, verse 4. These the products of the heaven and the earth when they were created on the day of the Lord who made the heaven and earth. Now all the trees of the field were not yet on the earth, and the herb of the field was not yet sprouted. The Lord God had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man to work the soil. A mist ascended from the earth and watered the whole surface of the earth of the soil. And the Lord formed the man of the dust from the ground, and he blew into his nostrils the soul of life. The man became a living being. So, in our description here, what is his heritage then? Where did he begin? In dirt, but what was the gift? Life. Life was given. So, his heritage is dirt. But the gift is something which God gave all the Israelites when they came into the land of Egypt and of Israel. They divvied up the land. Who got what? You get this property, you get that property, you get this land, that territory, you conquer over here. All the gifts that God gave was in the land. Those were the gifts. Now, God already built the land. The land already existed, right? He didn't say, look, I'm going to create new land for you. Here's the land. No. The land already existed. The gift is him act of giving it to you as it is now yours. That's the gift. So in this aspect, when man equals dirt, equals the land, his gift isn't just the dirt. That's what he is. His gift was the life. Our spirit. That is his actual true heritage gift. Yes, Sean.
Something just popped off the page here for me. Right before he's breathing the breath of God, he describes the mist coming up out, the
yes.
water coming.
Yes.
We have the imagery when they're passing through the Red Sea. We have the imagery of baptism.
That's true, too.
So this is connection to the breath as well as water.
It is. That is true. Because he has to form the dust. It makes like a mud type of thing, which requires water to be part of it. But that aspect of water is not in Shavuot. That aspect of water is in the fall feasts, which we'll get to the later. Water is built in there, which we're not talking about water today. Today we're talking about just this gift of this spirit life. We're not going to go the water aspect today. Correct. That is what I'm saying. But you're absolutely right. Water is part of what he was made from. So there was dirt and there was water, both mixed together to make this dust or whatever he's making out of. And he dumps in, of course, his breath, which is the actual gift that comes from God. That's what we talk about today. So the restoration of a man to his heritage for every 50 years is a restoration of what he begins with. Well, all men begin one where? One spot. We all began with Adam and Eve. And what was the gift from Adam and Eve that God gave to Adam? The breath of life. That is the gift, which he then passes down to generation to generation. Adam's children did not inherit dirt, did they? They inherited life. They didn't give birth, Eve didn't birth mud. She didn't birth dirt. She birthed a living thing that was alive, that actually could breathe and eventually talk and, of course, kill later on. But that's not the point. The point is that's what the gift was, the actual giving of life. That's what Adam passes down to every one of us. It's the life. So the heritage is life. And the life comes from one source. The only one who can give it, God. Which we'll talk about that later on in the book of John. Okay, so that's part of the restoration. So the man's restored in this idea of restoration to your heritage every 50 years, which means we are restored every 50 years. The idea is, the cons behind it, every 50 years you're restored to what your heritage is, which is life, to grant life. What is life? A philosophical statement. What is life? The meaning of life. No. What is life? Well, we'll talk about that next. So let me erase this. Because restoration to giving it back to you, restoring it, giving you what was once yours, is part of what this cycle of these jubilees are. And Messiah then wraps it all up in a neat little bow for us in Book of John, chapter 5, which we won't get there just yet. Restoration is what your gift is. What is that gift to you? What does that mean to you? What is life to you? What is it to me? Well, I can move. I can walk. I can talk. I can do things with it. So I have activity. That's part of life. It is. But there's a bigger aspect of life that is tied into the 50 years as well as the 7 years, which is how Shavuot's built into it. It's written up here. I'll circle the other word up here. It's the English word, of course. Liberty. To be free. To do something. A man who is bound, is he free to do something? Who is bound, is he free to do anything? No, he's bound. If he is bound, is he using his life? No, he's just existing. If he is unbound, is he then using his life? Theoretically, so not from a television. Hopefully, he's free to find something if he wants to. Theoretically, if he's unbound, he's using his life to live, to do something or to do things. That's where your liberty comes from. That's the idea of too free to do something, whatever it may be. You know, that we have the life, pursuit of life. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. So free to do those things. It's the act of actually going from bound to unbound. That's the idea of liberty, of life. Adam, when he was mud, could he do anything? No. When he is not mud, is he free to do things? Yes, including to eat of a wrong tree. He's free to do anything he wants because he now has life. He has the ability to do something which he couldn't do before. A tree has a type of life. Is it bound? Yes, it's stuck in the ground. Can it say, you want? I want to go visit the Rockies this weekend? No, it can't. It's going to die in the process. Can it say, you know what? I want to go go boating. I want to go visit somebody. I want to go see how my children are doing. No, it's bound. Things that are alive can move and do things. Those have the breath of life in them. They can actively do stuff. Yes, Anne.
But a tree has seed, and seed can fly, and seed can go.
That's true. Seeds can fly. That is true. The fly has to go find the binding spot. So in this process of liberty, which of course also record, which we already read, which was the nine, in Leviticus 25, the last few verses there, that he gets to go free. He, his children with him, everything he has with him, goes free in those the 7 years. He is free to do what? To not work for the slave master. He can choose to if he wants to, but he's free to do something else. That's part of your freedom. That's part of the life. It's part of the process. So to understand Shavuot, we have to understand these concepts of restoration and liberty because they're built into it. That's where Messiah instructs us. In the process of liberty, there's more than a few aspects of liberty. And one of them we're going to go to is in John chapter 5. Now, this occurrence, by most accounts, occurs on Shavuot. So some argue it doesn't, but this is John chapter 5, the book of John chapter 5. So the timing of this chapter 5, this is the feast day following Passover and Unleavened Bread. So the Passover and the bread has already occurred in chapter 3 and 4. And then in chapter 5, it corresponds to Shavuot. And then in chapter 6 and 7 correspond to fall feasts. So because they're actually recorded, they actually spells out in chapter, I think it's chapter 7 or chapter 6, I can't remember what it is. Yeah, chapter 7 actually talks about the Feast of Tabernacles. Chapter 6 trying to make him king. Well, making king, of course, obviously corresponds to trumpets, because that's what trumpets are all about. Making someone king, you're now my king. So chapter 6 is the king of trumpets, or trumpets. So chapter 5 is focused around Shavuot. John chapter 5. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, there in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In this lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the water to move. For an angel would go down a certain time in the pool, stir up the water for them. Whoever stepped in first, after stirring the water, was made well of whatever disease he had. Now a certain man was there who had an infirmity for 38 years. When Yeshua, Jesus, saw him lying there and knew he had already been in that condition for a long time, he said, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus answered him, take up your bed and walk. And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed and walked. And that was the Sabbath. So on Shavuot, the whatever year that was, Messiah had a man who was paralyzed for 38 years, said, take up your bed and walk, made him no longer paralyzed. Now, as I mentioned before, I use the example on purpose. A bound man, is he free? Is he able to live his life? No. An unbound man, is he free? Is he able to live his life? Is a paralyzed man bound or unbound? He's bound. He's paralyzed. I'm not sure if it's waist down, neck down. Who makes the difference? He's paralyzed. He is bound. So what did Messiah give him on Shavuot? Freedom, liberty, life. He gave him those parts. So in this John, the first part,
I had it if this was during Pesach time, not Shavuot.
No, Pesach happened on, where is it? Chapter 5.
How can you show in the
chapter 5
right
was Passover.
Yeah, chapter 5, that's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry, 5, chapter 4, Yes, Passover is in chapter, was it chapter, cleanse the temple, Passover, in verse 13 of chapter 2, we start with Passover, and then it continues on for chapter 2 and 3, and then, so Passover is in that time. And then, of course, continues on with the disciple, chapter 4, the chapter 5 is the next holy day. It corresponds to the events of what we're actually talking about. It matches Shavuot. The whole idea of giving life or giving unbound freedom or unbinding someone who is bound. That's which corresponds to Shavuot. So chapter 5 is Shavuot. Chapter 4 and, 2, 3, and 4 are Passover. And of course, there are some first fruits, the Omer counting cycle subbed in there as well in the book of John. Okay, so let's see. We have, Shavuot. Oh, yeah. So. This man who was once bound is now unbound. He now has liberty. Now, I want to ask you a question. When Messiah asked him in verse 6, do you want to be made well? I'm going to ask you, let's go out just out of the limb here. Let's pretend you're paralyzed for 38 years. Why does someone ask you that? He's teaching something. What's he teaching? Why would Messiah ask this question? It's in part a question of faith, but it's in part a question of symbolism. What the day means and what the sequence means. You see, the cycle of counting of the 7 years, 7 days, and 7 days, and 7 days, all up to 50 days, you're counting something. You're counting freedom. If we examine a little closer at the idea of the 7 year sabbatical rest, what happens at the end of, like, for example, any random set of seven? If the Hebrew man says, I do not want to be free, what happens? And all put into his ear, and he serves all the way until Jubilee, whatever that is. And then it goes free. So Messiah asks him, do you want to be made well, or do you want to be free? What's the man's response? Yes. Right. I can't get free. I am bound. He wants to be, but he's bound. He can't get free. Well, how do you get free then? If you are bound, meaning if you are in the 7 year counting cycles, and you say, I'm stuck here, master. I can't go off on my own and live my life. I have to stay with you and serve you until the Jubilee year. You can't get free. No one can get you free. Well, how do you get free? It requires Jubilee year. And what is the Messiah going to do? He frees him. So what's the Messiah doing? In this, the 50th day, which corresponds to a 50-year cycle concept, this is the idea, is that the paralyzed man is allowed free now. His time of service, of bindingness, his paralysis for 38 years, is now over. So that's his freedom. So he gets the freedom. That's Messiah's asking him. In the previous, the previous 7 years of a slave's life, you may ask by the end of the sixth year, before the seventh starts, do you want to be free or not? And the slave says yes or no. In this case, the man obviously wants to be, but for 38 years, he could not say, yes, I want to be free. Yes, Dan.
Messiah freed a lot of people on Shabbat.
Yes, he did. He did. He used that day a lot of times to free people. It was had to do with, in most people's opinions, mine included, it had to do with the year he was alive and doing his work. It was a Jubilee year. The whole year is based on the idea of freedom. Every Shabbat, every holiday, they're all based on the concept of freedom. The whole year is. So anything he's doing during this year cycle, he is observing or being the freedom catalyst, the tool used to create freedom throughout the year. That's why you see... I'm sorry, one at a time. No. The Jubilee year would have ended roughly 2 weeks before he died. Because Jubilee year ends and starts the first of the year, which is roughly late March, early April. It's the first time of the year. It's Aviv, the first day of the month. That's Jubilee starts and year ends. So he starts his work about a month or so beforehand with the water and the wine thing. As he works away, and he spends his whole year doing work as far as freeing people with their life and everything, all ailments and everything else you got, and he dies 2 weeks after Jubilee ends. So he is the Jubilee starting and end. That's his cycle. Now, that's Some have argued he didn't do it in 1 year. Some say it took him 3 years. It's hard to prove 3 years. It's easier to prove 1 year than it's three. So my opinion, it's 1 year. He did the whole thing about a year. That's my opinion because it's easier to demonstrate that than it is to demonstrate three. Anyway, so that's all kinds of Jubilee year. So he's releasing somebody, of course, on Shavuot on the 50-day cycle, and he does something that occurs on the 50-year cycle in a Jubilee year. So he gives somebody who was bound unboundness. They're now free in this process. So we know that Shavuot, according to Messiah's actions, indicate freedom. It's a catch. It's always a catch. It's a catch. It's a catch. You got to serve something. You got to do something in particular. When the man, of course, explained his condition, of course, besides said, take your bed and walk. Let's continue on in verse 10. The Jews therefore said to him, who was cured? It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed. He answered them, he who made me well said to me, take up your bed and walk. And they asked him, who was the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? But the one who was healed did not know who it was, so Jesus had withdrawn a multitude being in that place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, see, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you. The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who made him well. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath. So we have a man who was granted liberty with a catch. A burden was put on him. Okay, how do we rectify this? Yes, Deanne.
Because we are too given freedom under our master, and we grow and learn his Torah, not that for it's going to save us, but so we can live in his kingdom. So we put off our bad and put on his righteousness, and in his laws our way of living. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And the Jews here, when they're talking to the man, saying, hey, it's not lawful for you to carry your bed. Well, let's discuss where they got this tradition from. You're right, it is tradition, but we'll discuss where it came from. Because they didn't just invent it off their head. Somebody actually wrote it down for them. This is how you will live. And this is where the Jews at the time were having confusion, difficulty with this concept of this man carrying his bed. By the way, he's carrying his bed through the gates of the temple, which a holy place. This is not your own personal house. This is the God's temple. You're carrying your bed, which I don't know how heavy the bed was. Probably a few pounds, give or take. I don't know. But he had to carry it because Jesus told him to carry it. How far he carried it, I don't know. But he carried it through the gates, or in the gates of the temple. That's where the pool is at. The Bethesda pool. It's near the sheep gate. Jeremiah 17 discusses what the Jews' concept was as far as what the issue is at. This is what they're doing to him. So Jeremiah chapter 17. This is their problem. Starting in verse 19. Now this is an instruction given from Jeremiah to the people of Judah as far as how they are to live their life for observing the Sabbath. This, of course, the Sabbath, it's a holy day Sabbath at Messiah's time. Thus the Lord said to me, this is verse 19, go and stand at the gate of the children of the people by which the kings of Judah come in and by which they go out, in all the gates of Jerusalem. Say to them, hear the word of the Lord, you kings of Judah and all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem who enter by these gates. Thus says the Lord, take heed to yourselves and bear no burden on the Sabbath day, nor bring it in by the gates of Jerusalem, nor carry a burden out of your houses on the Sabbath day, nor do any work, but hallow the Sabbath day as I commanded your fathers. But they did not obey, nor incline their ear, but made their neck stiff, and they might not hear nor receive instruction. And it shall be, if you diligently heed me, says the Lord, to bring no burdens to the gates of the city on the Sabbath day, but hallow the Sabbath day to do no work in it, then shall enter the gates of the city kings and princes, sitting on the thrones of David, riding in chariots and on horses, they and their princes accompanied by the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the city shall remain forever. And they shall come in from the cities of Judah and from the palaces around places around Jerusalem, from the land of Benjamin, from the lowland, from the mountains of the south, bringing burnt offerings and sacrifices, grain offerings, incense, bringing sacrifice of praise to the house of the Lord, But if you will not heed me to hallow the Sabbath day, such as not carrying a burden when entering the gates of Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, then I will kindle a fire in its gates, and it shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem, and it shall not be quenched. That was in Jeremiah 17, verse 19 through 27. That was the instruction Jeremiah gives to all the Jews, all of Judah, before the great exodus expulsion, or diaspora. They went off to exile. That's the word. Thank you. Ooh, sorry, the X. off to Nebuchadnezzar. Yes.
He's bringing it out, not in now.
He's carrying it. He's in the temple at the time when he meets Messiah again. I don't know if he brought his bed. I don't know how he brought his bed through or in or out. I don't know how he went through the gate, whether he was inside the gate, he went out the gate, was out the gate, went in the gate. I'm not sure. Either way, he carried his bed. It was in Jerusalem, which is also prohibited. It's in the city. So whether it was in Jerusalem or just temple alone, it's still not acceptable. So that's the stance of the Jews in Messiah's time, seeing this man carrying his bed and saying, wait a minute, we were instructed umpteen hundred years ago to not do that. And we don't have kings, we don't have princes, we're ruled by Rome, we're oppressed, we're taxed heavily. We're not supposed to be doing these things. If we don't do these things, then we'll get kings, we'll get princes, we won't be taxed by Romans anymore. We're trying to accomplish this great kingdom again. So why are you violating the main principle that Jeremiah gave to us? And the man's answer, well, what did he answer for this problem? He was carrying the bed. What did he say? The man told me to do it. The man who healed me, he said so. So I did it. Well, as a result, is the sin, I'm using the term sin very loosely, is the violation, is a better word. Is a violation on the part of the previously paralyzed man. Is it his fault he's carrying his bed? Or is it Messiah's fault that Messiah told him to? But the man has explained he was instructed to go do it. Who is more guilty, the student or the teacher? The teacher. The teacher is the problem. So Jews say, okay, man, whatever his name is, I don't really care. You were once paralyzed, you're up and now you're not. You were carrying a bed, you're not supposed to be. Your teacher told you, I'm going to go talk to your teacher. Who is he? Yes, Rose.
My teacher is without sin. He is Lord of the Sabbath.
Exactly. That's what we get to talk about. And that's the rest of the book of John 5 talks about. That's what Messiah is instructing and tells people about in the rest of this chapter. Yes, Kat.
The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus.
Eventually, yeah. He had to go back and find out who the guy was, then went back and instructed. He did a relay thing. Which is eventually Messiah, of course, is found out, if you use the term loosely. Yes, Anne.
Well, it's a contrast, because if you think about blind Bartimaeus, he was also 38 years blind. And, yep. And when he received his sight, they said to him too, who did this? Who did this thing to you? But blind Bartimaeus defended the Lord, and he went on and he said, this is unbelievable that a man loses sight and gain it back, and that you condemn him as born blind. Okay, so you know that no one in the history of mankind has healed
him. Has done that.
And so I really fear for this person who was healed on the Sabbath and with the bed thing. Because when Jesus warns you and says,
sin no
be careful,
more.
Sin no more.
Right.
Lest the worst thing happen to you.
Now, hopefully, after 38 years of paralysis, I don't know how old he actually was. I assume he wasn't born paralyzed, but he may have been. 38 years of paralysis. Hopefully, he did a good job the rest of his life, however long it was. I don't know. So, of course, the sin, if you use the term loosely, is upon Messiah. He's the teacher. He's the instructor. Of course, he's sin-free. So what's going on? Well, all of that has to do with Shavuot and the cycle of freedom. And what is a burden and what isn't? Let's continue on in chapter 5 of the book of John. I already read this part. I'll reiterate it one more time. This is verse 14. So afterwards, Jesus found and said, see that you've been made well. Sin no more, this worst thing happened come upon you. That's Messiah's key. That's his tool. That's the explanation. That's the part. That's the bell ringer that says, this is what excused and explained everything. With that sentence. when he said, sin no more, lest a worse thing happen to you, what was the man's real burden? His sin. Whatever the sin was, I don't know. Whatever the sin was, the paralysis that's a result from the sin. So, there is a physical definition of don't carry a burden. There's a spiritual one too. We know the differences between them. Does God wish for you to be full of sin coming into his temple? No. That's the opposite. Don't even enter Jerusalem. Go fix this. Clean up your scenario first. Don't be full and living in your sin. I'm not saying someone who makes mistakes, but who lives in their sin. There's a difference between living in your sin versus having sinned. There are opposite spectrums. Yes.
So the Pharisees, or as they put it, the Jews, were more focused on the physical man.
Right.
Versus the spiritual.
Well, they knew the man was paralyzed. Like, wow, how did you not be paralyzed anymore? Instead of focusing on that aspect, say, so you're carrying your bed? Of the two things, which is more important? Look, he's carrying his bed. Everybody look at the guy carrying the bed. Or, holy cow, the guy's walking. How'd that happen? Wait, there's a world of difference between the two of them and what they focus on. They did what they thought they were, what they were instructed to do. Help the people obey the laws. That they were taught to do. They were trying to do that. Well, this isn't defense added. This is offense that Jeremiah points out to. This is what God has stated you will do, how you will observe Sabbath. In the burdening of carrying burdens. What they didn't understand is what is a burden and what isn't. There's a world between what is and isn't. Yes, defense was the type that they looked at. Physical was the burden as opposed to spiritual was the burden. Yes, Alma.
So are you going to explain what the burden is?
That's what I was going to go to next. Yeah.
Okay, the burden was not to do business.
In part. We'll go there in a minute. We're not there yet. We'll go there in a minute. We have to finish where Messiah is at first before we go into what is and isn't burdens, what they actually are. So Messiah gave him his instruction, and he's pointing out to him his burden that he's doing as far as what got him in this paralysis to begin with. I don't know what it was, but whatever, some kind of a sin, whether it's his, somebody else's, I don't know. Some kind of a sin got him there. To not get worse, what's worse than paralysis? Well, some would argue death, some would say no. Not much is worse than paralysis, but don't sin anymore. Stop the sin so you don't get something worse. Your burden of a greater binding isn't put on you, because paralysis is pretty binding. But his point is, stay free. Stay alive. Live. Go do. Be part of. So let's see. So we're going through Messiah chapter 5, or John chapter 5. Let's continue forward. So, for this reason, the Jews, in verse 16, they sought to persecute Jesus and sought to kill him. Verse 17. But Jesus answered and said, my Father has been working until now, and I have been working. Therefore, the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because not only did he break the Sabbath, but he also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. Jesus answered and said to them, most surely I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he sees the Father do. But whatever he does, the Son also does in like manner. The Father loves the Son and shows him all things and all that he himself does. And he will show him greater works than these, that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. So, let's stop there for a moment. In this concept of freedom, and life, and granted this, because that is your heritage, that's all of our heritage is life. That's what God originally gave us, that's his intent to always give to us, that is what our gift is, that's what we own, we can tangibly have it as life. In this living, or giving this paralysis man freedom, he gave him life again. And who has the authority over life? God does. And who does he give that authority to distribute evenly, or randomly, at this time was Messiah at this time. So Messiah is the controller or gifter of life. So the person who received this freedom after the 50 days of Shavuot is the same person or same type of person who would receive the Jubilee year of freedom is the gifter of life gave this. I have a question for you. Who gave us Jubilee years? God did. Did man do it? No. So man didn't give us freedom either. God did. God gave us freedom. He gave us life. He restores us to his own, what he started out to. God is the owner or gifter of these items. No one else gets to give them or take them away. This liberty, this man's carrying his bed, and he, of course, has life now. Of course, Messiah has is the controller of life, because verse 22 and 23 explains a problem. He is not controller of life. This is verse 22, continuing on. For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son, that all should honor the Son just as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who had sent him. Most surely I say to you, he who hears my word, believes in him who sent me, has everlasting life, and shall not come into judgment, but he has passed from death into life. Now we go to some details. In this law of liberty, this rule of freedom, how this is supposed to work, is we have life. Well, what is about this whole idea of, well, didn't this man sin? Didn't you just sin by telling him to carry a burden, walk through the gates and such? You violated the commandment. Why? How are you not judging him? Here's the details of explanation what Messiah just told them. I'm going to erase part of this. So, God Father gave all the authority of life to his Son. But there's one thing he won't do. Does not judge. Why is that? Why would the Father not judge? Let's imagine for a moment you're God. Some of us wish we were. God, grateful we're not. Imagine when you're God. You can do nothing wrong. Anything that does wrong dies in your presence. Anything that has done something wrong dies in your presence. There is no room for any wrongness to ever be near you. So, do you want him to be your judge? Will you ever live? No. So, if he's the judge, you couldn't survive. No flesh could survive. Animal, human, probably even trees too. Nothing could live. You'd be done. Well, so he's not the one judging. So therefore, what did Messiah say? The Son is the one who judges. So in this instance of this man who's paralysis and carrying his bed, who's his judge? Messiah is the judge. So the judge says the paralyzed man is not guilty. How could he do that? But why? What law is he standing on? Who says so? The scriptures are all about him. You see, he is the instructor and ruler of all things. How can he say the man's not guilty for carrying a burden? Because Messiah knows what a burden really is. He knows what a burden really is. It has nothing to do with a bed. It has nothing to do with this man. Because this man's burden wasn't his bed, was it? His burden was his paralysis. That was the burden. So is a man guilty of carrying his burden to the gate? No. His sin or his paralysis is not being carried around in Jerusalem. He once was. He was sprawled out there near the pool. That would be his burden in Jerusalem. Now he's not carrying it anymore. He wasn't guilty. It wasn't his burden. Your hand was up. Who was it? Bill?
Father put Abraham to sleep, and he's the one who walked between the halves.
Correct.
And he's the one that knows we can't do it. We can't keep these, all this stuff.
And that is true.
I understand what you're saying here. But he started it. He's going to finish it. We can't save ourselves.
Your actions won't do it.
Huh?
Your actions won't do it. You're saying your own salvation isn't done by you. In this kindness the Messiah gave this man, the healing of his paralysis, who has the authority to do it? Only Messiah does. So Messiah granted him life and judged him not for the carrying of the burden. He was already corrected or taken care of. On the other hand, another way, manner of looking at it, Messiah did judge him. That's what he said, sin no more. He explained, your problem, this paralysis, was based upon something you or somebody else did to you, whatever it was. Don't do it anymore. There is your judgment. Now, who has the authority to do it? Now, normally, we would say, well, if you were just looking at man's authority, we say, well, the authority has to do with, you know, the high priest of the authority, the government has the authority, they decide who's guilty of doing some crime or not. But Messiah is pointing out, the man's not guilty of carrying his burden. I have freed him from his real burden, the paralysis. And I've already judged him by telling him, don't sin anymore. The man's clear. He's done. He's clean slate. There is no guilt. That was the judgment. Messiah gives the judge. He's the judger. He judged this man who was laying on the ground, paralyzed, and judged him, knowing, all right, you've been here for 38 years. You have, whether he decided paying a price, I don't really care. The point is, he judged that this paralysis, this correction, is over. You are now free. He is no longer guilty. That's what his judging is. It's not the not guilty from carrying the burden. He's no longer guilty from the sin, whatever caused it. That was the judgment. But God doesn't do that. You and I will permanently be guilty of sin. Because if we sinned once, Adam sinned once, we're all sin. So God the Father doesn't do this. He doesn't say you're not guilty from sin. Only the Son can. Yes, John.
Let me follow my thought out here. So this always baffled me to go and sin no more. And then like, well, wait a minute, how can you not sin anymore? We're always going to miss the mark at some why we're in this carnal
right.
flesh. Wouldn't it be fair to say that because if he had faith and trusted in the Son of God, in Yeshua, therefore his sin would be covered? That would be the remedy of go and sin no more because he had trust now in the one who healed or was the healer.
In a number of examples where Messiah healed people, not all, but a number of them, the men were healed and immediately they stopped what they were doing and followed him. So they then were believed to have followed him. The man who was paralyzed didn't say what happened to him. I don't know what he did, in his life, who knows. But if he continued on and said, hey, you who have the power to do things that no one else can do, you have the authority to do things that no one else has ever done. Who has the true authority? That man's going to look at that in this individual Messiah and probably say, wow, you're really powerful. More than that, let's read all what Messiah said to amongst the Jews who were questioning him and probably the man who was there with them and read what he responds with. Messiah's not finished with this conversation. It explains more what that man then chooses to do if he follows Messiah from that point on. Yes, his sins are cleared. Because he follows him. If he doesn't follow him, that's a different story. I don't know what happens to the paralyzed man. It doesn't describe. Other examples, they did. Their sin, loosely, was forgiven them. I mean, they were healed. And they followed Messiah. Therefore, their sins were gone. They maintained, they recognized what true power is. And it wasn't the authorities. It was this individual. True power. Let's continue on in chapter 5. Oh, yes.
He did that with the adulteress, too.
Yes. Same process. And she went, what did she do? She spread the news. Was she a follower then? Well, yes, because she spread the news. That defines a follower. One who spreads the news about Messiah is following Messiah because they're talking about him. So she did, and her sins clearly were forgiven her for however long, whatever the details are, I don't know. The point is, at that point on, they were. And she believed him. If you believe him, you've believed him. It's pretty simple as that. Let's continue on. Verse 25. Most surely I say to you, the hour is coming and now is when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself and has given him the authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. So who is life? Who has life? Who gives it? Who takes it away? All Father and Messiah. So the Father has it. He has it. And who gives it? Messiah gives it. So this liberty, no longer bound, whether it be from paralysis, whether it be from blindness, whether it be from sin, makes a difference. No longer boundness. It's all given to by the Son. He has the authority to do it, to make the judgments, and to grant life. So that's what Shavuot is. This man received his judgment and received life after it on Shavuot. It's also, of course, pointed out in verse 25 that even the dead will get this as well. Of course, every resurrection of the dead and such, we'll discuss that some of the time. So even those who do not have life once had it and gave it up, they also receive it again. Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming which all who are in the graves will hear his voice. Come forth those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. I can of myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me. So he's explained, of course, the details as far as how this process is supposed to work in this process of judgment and granting of life. So we have Shavuot, which is the experience being lived out by the paralyzed man. And what is he getting? He's getting liberty or life giving granted to him. So getting life being granted to him, he's no longer paralyzed, free from his sins. That's the symbolism of Shavuot and, of course, Jubilee too. They're tied one and the same. So this process, what we learn of Shavuot and the cycle of counting is this idea of freedom. The idea of being set free. Now, of course, we discussed earlier, he has, there's lots of witnesses. The balance of the chapter discusses the various witnesses the Messiah has of himself that verifies he has authority to grant life and the authority, of course, obviously, to grant freedom. It discusses in the next few verses that John the Baptist, of course, witnesses of him, verse 31 through 35, discusses that John the Baptist discusses about him as far as bearing witness. Obviously, the works of Messiah bear witness of him, which is also covered this chapter, as well as the Father himself, who talks about Messiah doing these types of things, and the scriptures themselves. I'm going to jump down to the scripture verses in particular. The scripture verses jump to verse 39. You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and these are they which testify of me. But you are not willing to come to me that you may have life. I do not receive honor from men, but I know you, that you do not have the love of God in you. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, him you will receive. How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes from the only God? Do not think that I accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, in whom you trust. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. If you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? What did Moses write about? The law. The instructions. There are certain parts of a law in particular Messiah is referring to. You will live. You will live. You will live. You will live a long life, honor your father and mother. You will live in the land, do all these things, how to process people and how to treat one another. You will live. Choose life. So Messiah is about life. They said they search the scriptures thinking they have eternal life. Scriptures talk about it. They talk about how to live, not how to die. We say, well, yeah, but it tells about sin. No. The point is, the scriptures talk about how you live, not how you die. That's the purpose of the scriptures, how to live. And how do you live? The only one who can grant you life is him. So, you have to live whatever he says to live by. Well, he points out the scriptures talk about me. Therefore, that's what we're living by. That's the point behind this process. So the object or the goal of this discussion, as far as this part of the discussion today, is that Shavuot, and which this man received life and liberty, which he didn't have before, is part of the process of the restoration for the Jubilee cycle. Now, there's more to this. Any other questions so far before I jump to the next part of this topic? Good. Let me erase part of this. We're going to go back just a few verses in the same book, the same chapter, I mean. Okay. When the men pointed out to him in a few earlier verses, back in verse 12, who is meant to give your bed and walk? Verse 10. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed. That verse in particular. What exactly are they doing? Intentional or unintentional? What are they doing? They're quoting a law. which is in this particular instance, the man was doing something which they interpreted as being incorrect, being wrong. What were they going to want him to do? They don't want to carry his bed, obey the law. They're using the law in a different form. The law, in this case, law of oppression, to oppress. You can use the Torah to do life and live life. You can also use it to oppress, if you so choose. It's a misuse of a law. It is, in other words, binding or creating a burden on someone. You are enslaving the individual or individuals.
Jesus said, you know, come to me, all you who burden and are heavy laden, and
take
my yoke upon you, and I will give you rest.
Right. And that's the idea. That's the idea. His whole year of Jubilee that he lived, that was his principle, which you run across many times over again. Your sins, your burdens, it's explained many different ways throughout the entire New Testament. This whole idea of sins and burdens are enslaving you. Become free. Become free. So, in this oppression process, what are they doing then? They're using God's law not to grant freedom, but to grant oppression. The opposite of it. To enslave someone, which is the reverse use of it. We look at the laws and say, well, wait, the Torah says you can have slaves, and you can do different things, all these various things which you are permitted and not permitted to do. Wait a minute, these are limitations. Contrast that to what people normally do. What we normally would do is on our own account, and that is recorded multiple times throughout our history of slavery. For example, this is one example we're doing slavery today. What does man do with slavery? We enslave you till you die. And what if I die first, you're my child's slave too. That's slavery in man's way. What's God's way? Let's find every route you can to get free. There's totally different aspects of how this process is supposed to work. Slavery in God's eyes, all right, you're a slave, how do we get you free? Slavery in man's eyes, you're free, how do I make you a slave? That's just the way in which we do things are complete opposites of each other. So in this process, what God's dealing with, all right, when we have enslaved individuals, people who are being enslaved, how to make them unenslaved? Yes. Bill.
Is there some place in there where it says that the letter of the law kills, but the spirit of the law gives life, or brings life?
It's a paraphrase. I don't recall exactly where the scripture is, okay. But along those lines, yes. Where was I? Oh, right. So we have this oppression process to oppress someone. To oppress. You use the law to oppress. But that was not the intent of the law. As Messiah points out, the law is based upon one thing. To figure out how to live. That was the goal of the law. How to live. God said, you will do this, you won't do that. You live like this, you won't live like that. You treat people well like this, you don't treat people poorly like that. Your relationship with God is like this, it is not like that. That's how you live your life. It's the way and instructions on how to live. That was the purpose of the law. Men use it to oppress. The law, which of course, enslaves. So when they come to this paralyzed man and say, you are violating the law, what are they doing to him? They're oppressing him. They are bringing him back under their enslavement, their control. So they are enslaving the paralyzed man. They want him paralyzed again. Not in the same sprawl on the ground. They're paralyzed under whose authority? Theirs. You see, when Messiah granted the man life, Messiah has the control over life, right? He has control over judgment, right? So whoever has power over your life and your death, he is your master, right? So Messiah just became the paralyzed man's master in the paralyzed man's ideas or his in the way he looks at things. He saw, you granted me life and freedom, everybody else didn't. So you are now my master, I am your slave, so to speak. When everybody else says, no, slave, paralyzed man, you are actually still under our authority, you are still our slave. He is no longer, he has this pull both directions. The law, which people were using law to enslave him, versus the man who just freed him. Who do you obey? The one who has the power to free you. Because the men who are trying to enslave you don't. This, of course, came up a few different times. It's mentioned earlier regarding the blind man who was blind from birth, I think it was, or near birth, and how he was able to see it, everybody recognized, he could see the people, the leadership had a hard time with that, trying to figure out how to deal with this blind man who was not blind anymore. Same process. They recognize who has the freedom, who has the power, sorry, over them and who doesn't. So now he recognizes who's free and who's not. So the people are trying, the authorities try to use the law to oppress the man, to bring him back into enslavement, when he was already given life and is no longer paralyzed anymore. Life is brought into freedom. Is it the proper use of the law? No, it is not. It is a common use, but a proper use. Let's go back to Leviticus 25, because we will it instructs us on how to treat one another quite a bit better. Back to 25, and it explains in this process of freedom, of freeing people every 7 years, as well as on Jubilee, Leviticus gives us explanations on how we do certain things. And oppression is the opposite of them. Oh, yes, Carrie.
It just kind of made me think of the ox in the ditch. It was like Messiah pulled the ox out of the ditch and they tried to push him back in.
Yes, they tried to push him back in. This is chapter 25 of Leviticus, which discusses this idea of freedom and how this process is supposed to work. It covers it and repeats itself basically five different times. I'm not going to go through every context. But the whole point is, Leviticus 25 in verse 14, it points out, when you make a sale to your fellow, or make a purchase from the hand of your fellow, do not aggrieve one another, which means do not oppress, do not mistreat one another in the process. It repeats itself also in verse 17, each of you shall not oppress or aggrieve his fellow. You shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. And of course, also repeats itself yet again in 35 through 38. If your brother becomes impoverished and his means falter in your proximity, you should strengthen him, a proselyte or resident, so that he can live with you. Do not take from him interest and increase. You shall fear the Lord your God and let your brother live with you. Do not give him your money for interest, and do not give your food for increase. I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan to be God unto you. What is the repeated instruction over and over and over again in this process? Do not take advantage, do not oppress. And what were they doing? Oppressing. Taking advantage and oppressing. Oppressing someone who was ignorant of the law. Oppressing somebody who was inexperienced for whatever reason, unknowledgeable, ignorance. Or oppressing somebody who just is afraid or full of fear, unknown. Because they don't know what the law says. The authority is supposed to know, right? Your teacher is supposed to know. Yeah, they look good, look great. So all that process is being used to oppress, and yet the instructions given for Jubilee, as well as the 7-year release cycle, is to not oppress, to not mistreat, to not facilitate someone's further oppression or enslavement. Yeah, that's exactly what they're doing. So who is truly violating the law then? The Pharisees were. They're the ones violating it. It wasn't Messiah with the paralyzed man. The one who were oppressing him were the actual violators. And that's when he points out to them in John 5, it said, you seek life, you have no love. You do not know God. You do not have love. You do not have, because you are trying to oppress. If you don't have God, don't know God, you don't have life. You don't have your freedom you're after. You have the exact opposite. You're enslaved yourselves. Hope that makes sense. Now, let's go where we're going to end today. Then we understand the basic idea of what freedom was supposed to be, and we understand how to not oppress one another, and we understand what restoration was supposed to be. So the idea of freedom and restoration and non-oppression gives you something. So let's erase some of the stuff. I'll rewrite it up here again in another way. I'm going to go through all these various scriptures. The idea of oppression is also spelled out in Amos, chapter, almost the entire book, as well as Isaiah chapter 10 about making laws that oppress the poor of God's people. Isaiah 10 is highly looked down upon by God. So we have life, / liberty. You have restoration. And I had written up here acceptance. We haven't talked about acceptance yet. So the life and liberty process, which we wrote down and talked about extensively, has to do with granting freedom. Freedom to live, which freedom to live equals life. That's what it is. Freedom to live is to live, to go do something, you live your life. And that stuff, freedom, live, life, that's all in the authority of God, Messiah in particular, to give. That includes this freedom of liberty and justice for all. That's our pledge. The idea of freedom and the cost of how this is supposed to give out to everybody includes a judgment. That's how you get freedom. That's how you get it. God has to give it to you. Why would he give it to you versus somebody else? We ask, look at you. Say, what are you? What are you going to do with it? Judge you, discuss your past, and deal with these issues, and get better, and get past them, and grant you freedom, grant you life. That's how the process of life. Restoration, we talked about previously, was about restoring what your heritage was to give you rest. So heritage. And what is our heritage from God the Father?
Dirt,
breath. So breath, yeah, it's good dirt. I'm sure it wasn't a lot of, you know, bacteria in it. It would be very nice dirt, I'm sure. If whatever the coloring, who knows? So heritage is breath, which is life. So the heritage, the restoring us, has to do with giving us life again. Because we are dirt. We are the dirt. You are the dirt, but you get life. The dirt is living. So you are dirt, that's what you were. Your heritage, the gift given to you, was life. So we have liberty, or life was granted by God, my Messiah in particular, with judgment, which went through man's sin no more. So all this process of life and judgment is granted to man at Shavuot. And restoration is, of course, given to at Jubilee. And, of course, obviously in Shabbat as well, to various degrees. So in order to restore someone with life, how do you get that? How do you get it? How do you get this life? How do you get my heritage back? Because, by the way, in case you haven't noticed, all of us are going to die. We're all going to die. I know, it's a shock, isn't it? We're all going to die. So we have our inheritance right now, because you're alive and you're doing things. When you're dead, do you have your inheritance? No, there is no celebration of God, no worship of God or praise of God in the grave, as David points out many times. So how do you get it? Well, there's one way. Let's go to the book of Acts. This, of course, is the classical chapter we go to for Shavuot, Acts book chapter 2. Now, when the day of Pentecost had fully come, they were all with one accord, and suddenly came a loud sound from heaven of a rushing mighty wind, and it filled the whole house where they were sitting. It appeared to them divided tongues of fire as it sat upon each one of them. And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. Now there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men, from every nation under heaven. And there was the sound occurred, and the multitude came together, and they were confused, because everyone heard them speak in his own language. Then they were all amazed and marveled, saying to one another, "Look, are not all these who speak Galileans? And how is it we hear in our own language, in which we were born? Parthians, Medes, Elamites, those who dwell in Mesopotamia, Judea, that place, Pontus and Asia, that one too, and Egypt, and Libya, joining Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jew and proselyte, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them speaking in our own tongues, and the wonders of God's works." So the wonderful works of God. And so they were all amazed, perplexed, saying to one another, "What does this could mean?" Others mocking, said, "They're full of new wine, they're drunk." So what did they receive?
Life
from the Spirit of God, didn't they? How'd they get that? That's pretty cool. Yeah, blew up. But it's a bunch of wind. Funny. What did he breathe into? Yeah. What did he breathe into Adam? Yeah. The breath. It's God's spirit. His strength, his breath, his life. That's what it is. Nefesh, technically what Adam received. The Ruach is what this is. So this breath of life, this granting life, this granting of freedom, what does it boil down to in our everyday spiritual form? Because we just read about the paralyzed man. That was a very physical concept. Paralyzed, not paralyzed. You know, bound, unbound. We also discussed and read about slavery. You know, slave, not slave. Rest, not rest. We get the physical. What's the spiritual idea behind all these things? So this life and freedom is not just a physical thing. It's a spiritual concept. The idea of freedom, what is that? Well, it's the idea that you were not enslaved to someone or something else. It is an idea as much as it is a physical thing. Freedom is a spiritual concept in our hearts. For example, if you're full of sin and you know it, do you feel free? No, you feel guilty. Is guilt a physical thing or a spiritual thing? It's dominantly spiritual, because guilt is what you think. No one else is saying, look, he's guilty. Well, unless he didn't commit a crime. He feels or believes himself or herself guilty. That is not a physical concept. That is the internal idea that is inside of us, that we feel guilty. So guilt is a feeling. It's a spiritual idea inside of, just like anxiety is. You are torn in multiple ways. It's all inside of you. Much like shame is the same concept. Shame is not a physical thing. It is a spiritual thing. You feel shamed. Spiritual and feelings are very, very similar in how they deal with things. Not we're talking about loving something. We're talking about the idea of a consequence or a benefit or a negative on something which you've done or haven't done. So this freedom... I'm sorry, what was that? Yeah, we're going to get there. We're still working. Sorry. We'll get the fire and the wind. So we have freedom. So freedom is this idea of granting these things. And these people now have, the apostles here, they receive something strange, a spirit that filled them with, had wind or had a sound of wind. Wind and like firing tongues. Something about fire on their tongues. Whatever that looked like, I don't know. I wasn't there, so I can't say it. So the spirit of wind or fire was on it. Let's continue on reading. So others said they were full of new wine. Of course, Peter standing up with 11, he raised his voice and said, the men of Judea and all who dwell in Jerusalem, let this be known to you, and heed my words. These are not drunk, as you suppose. It's only the third hour of the day. It's still morning time. But this is what is spoken by Joel the prophet, and it shall come to pass the last days, says God, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons, your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions. Your old men shall dream dreams. Now men servants, and my maid servants, I will pour out my spirit in those days. They shall prophesy. And I will show wonders in heaven above and signs in the earth beneath. Blood, fire, vapor, smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the coming of the great and notable day of the Lord. It shall come to pass that whoever calls the name of the Lord shall be saved. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves also know. Him being delivered by determined counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by lawless hands and have crucified and put to death, whom God raised up, having loosed the pain to death, because it was not possible that he should be held by it. So we have this spirit that is now inside of Peter, that's giving instruction to everybody else. This spirit is telling them something very particular. What's he telling them particular about this individual that they killed? Yeah, so what he did, this man who, by the way, has the authority of life, he is, life is in him, all around him, is not compatible with death. Death couldn't hold him. Because life and death are opposites. They are. They don't mix. You're alive or you're dead. You're not both. There's a word for it, yeah. Life and death. They don't hold each other. So he's explaining this spirit, this wind force within inside of Peter and all the other 11 who are speaking, our understanding, their concept. They're trying to teach people that this life this individual gave, and gave to paralyzed men, gave to all of us, and is now responsible for this particular sound you're hearing, this life that you're hearing, the strange sound you've got, this strange ability, the strangeness. All of this is based upon the idea that this individual is not compatible with death, who you killed. Let's continue on. For David says concerning him, I foresaw the Lord always before my face. He is at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart rejoiced, my tongue was glad, more my flesh was also rested in my hope. In hope. Because you will not have my soul, leave my soul in Hades. Nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You have made known to me the ways of life. You will make full of joy in your presence. Men, brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried. His tomb is with us to this day. Therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God has sworn an oath to him, that all the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ, the anointed one, to sit on his throne. He, foreseeing this, spoke concerning the resurrection of the Messiah, and his soul was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God raised up, of which we are all witnesses. Therefore, being exalted to the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he poured out this which you now see and hear. For David did not ascend to heaven, but he says himself, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand, and make your enemies your footstool. Therefore, all the house of Israel know assuredly that God has made this Jesus whom you crucified both Lord and Christ. Now, this is instruction. The responsibility, this power, the spirit that's granted to you, which David, of course, explains with the help of explanation from Peter, that it wasn't applying to David, this lack of death, this life that we want to receive, that comes from liberty, comes from restoration, it comes from all these details that comes, sorry, it manifests itself in all these details. It comes from Messiah himself. It all comes, it doesn't come with death. Therefore, it doesn't come with enslavement. It doesn't come with enslavement. You see, Messiah's goal was to point out the Torah, the scriptures, the witnesses, has to do with life and freedom. It didn't come with enslavement, death. They're opposites. So enslavement and death is the opposite of life and spirit. It makes sense. Nothing shocking there. This Messiah who then granted that, however, which is odd, to a bunch of men, well, 11, well, eventually 12, 11 men, they received something. They received something odd. They received life, a different kind of life. You see, as I mentioned out earlier, all of us are going to die. We're flesh and blood. They did too. Some of the deaths are recorded. They all died. Nothing changed there. How come, then why didn't they receive their freedom, their life, the Messiah was supposed to give? Is that why they didn't, is that the reason what they didn't give? I have an answer for you. It's quite simple. The apostles, they all didn't live. They all died. They all buried, grave, some were killed, various reasons. Things happened to them. And all the various followers, some of them died, some lived. What eventually happens to them? They get resurrected in a particular way because in this, remember, everything in the Torah, everything in the Bible, everything we see, everything we read is a physical representation of what's in heaven. So I have a question for you. God is the grantor and owner of all life. When does he get his restoration? What is God's inheritance? Right. So this whole process of life and liberty and strength and restoration, it leads not to our restoration, but the Father's restoration. All the life is granted back to him in the form of people. So this process, this spiritual wind, the tongues of fire, the process of freedom living, and the process of heritage being returned and granting life, and getting free and the paralyzed man, no longer enslaved, those are all for human beings to comprehend and receive. That's how we get accepted. That's how we understand God. But how does God accept us? When he reaches his end, his seven-year cycle, his slaves are set free. And then he gets his property restored. Just like you get your property restored. It's his property. But in his cycle, it's the enslavement is the property. It's not the dirt. It's not the trees. Not the rocks. The property of the people. That's what he wants restored. Those things belong to him. So in Shavuot, and we discuss Shavuot in the counting of seven, the counting of 50 of cycles, it's the restoration of God's property to him. That's what it is. It's his property. So, back to our original, when we began out today, when it came to counting. Counting of Omer. What is being counted? We are. It's the counting of God's property. When the Messiah asked the man, do you want to be made well? What's the man saying when he says, well, I've been stuck here forever? What's he saying? What's he trying to point out to Messiah? He can't get there. He can't get there. He needs help. Well, how does God get him as one of his property? How does he get him back? He healed him. He granted him life. So this whole cycle of this Shavuot counting is counting God's property, his slaves, so to speak. He's getting them back. And the end of the Shavuot counting, he is now counted. He has received his property. As Messiah explained to them in John chapter 5. When it says, those who come forth, do not marvel at this, for the dead will come back, they will hear my voice. That was John chapter 5, verse 25 through 30. The dead will hear his voice, both those in the grave as well as those who were enslaved. You'll hear his voice. Well, to do what? Rise to the resurrection of life for those who have done well, and resurrection of condemnation for those who have done evil. That's God's property. The life we've done, who have done well. And that's where the Spirit of God comes in. How does it distinguish which one's his, which one isn't? They do have written down, but how'd they write it down? The Spirit of God writes it down. The Spirit of God writes it down. So that's his property, whatever he breathed into. Well, the Spirit of God is life. It's the idea. It's the concept of God's granting it to you. It is our inheritance. It's our heritage. It is his property that gets restored to him. Does that make sense? So when we look at Shavuot and seek the cycle of counting, it's a cycle of God counting his property, his life that he spread around and has been shared amongst others throughout the whole world. He's gathering or counting them in. And this process ending the Shavuot is he is concluding his count. Now, we didn't get there today, but who all gets included? Anybody who goes along with the Spirit of God is part of God's property. As it ends in the book of Acts, it says, verse 41, those who were glad to receive this word were baptized, 3,000 souls added to them that day. So that tells us that this process of God's life being spread around and being gathered back again is God gathering in and counting his life, his ownership, he's taking claim to these individuals. They're his. That's what we count. Yes.
And this is the sign between me and you if you keep my Shabbat.
It is. The sign. It is one of many signs. Also, circumcision is a sign too. He repeats himself a couple of different spots along the way of different ways in which he recognizes his property and ways which he recognizes they're not his property. So this individual with the burdens and the bed on his back and whatever else he was doing, he's being included in God's property. The freedom of his burden was, I am no longer somebody else's property. I now recognize the Messiah, this individual who has great power. He is the authority. He is the one who I trust. Trust in that. Does that make sense? So Shavuot is about that, to me. This is one of the aspects of it. It's this cycle of granting life, and that life will be restored to us and us to God, because we are his property. That's our heritage. Well, yeah, I think it's good news. Any questions or comments regarding Shavuot? Yes, Alma.
Well, you talk about the spiritual part of it, but when, you know, in the carrying of the mat, there's no law. And there's a lot of people that says, Jesus broke the law. And no, he didn't.
It's an instruction, not a law.
It's show me where in the law where it says you shall not carry your bed on Shabbat, or right. You shall not, heal anybody on Shabbat.
Right. It doesn't say
it
that.
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
So he did not break any law.
No, it wasn't the law.
He was upholding the law.
It wasn't the law. It was, that's what that points out. They were jumping on Jeremiah's instruction of what it was. And Jeremiah's instruction was the people of that time, in Jeremiah's time, they looked at God's law as an extreme burden. And they tried to manipulate ways to get around it. Are they obeying God's way of life? No. They're using God as God's tools as an oppression tool, an oppression detail. That's what they were using. And Jeremiah, when he got after them for doing so, which he did for many, many years, he was pointing out all your sins, all these burdens which you guys are doing, you are attempting to manipulate or work around the law. Because, as Alan pointed out, there is no burden that says you can't carry a burden, no laws you can't carry a burden on in the Torah. Great, I'll carry all my burdens on the Shabbat. Why not? It's free labor. You work your way around to get the details around the problem. So here is the idea of what you were supposed to do, and let's find every avenue, every loophole there is to work around it and not violate it. That is against the way of life. That is against liberty. That's against life. That's against the spirit of God. It's against his entire intention of the Torah. To find ways around a loophole, around the laws, was not the goal. It was supposed to live, because God wants to grant us life. He has life. He has a power of life. He wants to give it and share it so they can harvest it back and have it grow like a seed, like a tree. Who plants itself and doesn't move? But we get to move. Any other questions or comments regarding this topic? Yes, Anne.
When the man carried the sticks that time and the Lord put him down.
Yes.
What's the difference there then, except that the law was just given about Shabbat and or what?
High hand.
Yeah. It has to do with what the man was doing. So, for example, in this example of the man carrying the burden of the bed, he's carrying up as the man who has the authority over him, life and strength and judgment. He has the power. So he tells him, go carry your burden bed and walk. You're free. Your burden is now gone. This bed really isn't a burden. The man is not saying, hey, look, I'm going to flaunt the Shabbat. I'm going to flaunt God's laws. Look, I'm carrying a burden. Yes, you can. That would be an obvious example of flaunting God's laws. Because the man, the sticks, he was instructed not to do something, and he purposefully goes out and does it. Much like the people who went out from their tents to gather manna on the seventh day. They were instructed not to, and they purposely went out and did it. And what did God say? Get in your tents and don't come out. It's like sending your kid to your room. You're grounded. It's the same idea. Though it's a little more harsher than the grounding. You, here is your instruction, and you purposely went around it to test it out. Well, here's your instruction, man gathering sticks. You purposely went around it. You get penalties for it. I would classify that as testing God, yes. You're testing, you know, what are you going to do about it, God? It's almost like my child who says no when I tell him to go do something. What am I going to do about it? Well, yeah, exactly. You hit the bad end on the child. But he's testing it out. Yes, Alma.
And when he said, do not gather any, so stay, don't do anything,
right.
They were in the desert.
Right, there's not much out there.
So there was no wood. So
you
for him
work
to
for
be
it.
Disobedient, he had to go and look
really
around
yes.
And just be plain disobedient to God. Yep. So there was no, it's not like he went outside and he just started.
Take the stick on the side
twigs
of his.
And
yeah.
He was carrying wood.
He was doing his work. He was doing his work. And there's an old story about that. There was a man, what was it? I can't remember the guy's name. He wrote a little side story about that. Pick a guy carrying the sticks. The author had said, okay, so imagine you're in this group of umpteen thousand people, however they are, and they've been camped there for at least a week or two. And they all been having gathering wood, cook their fires on. Then Shabbat comes around and look around, where's the wood? Everybody's been using it and consuming it in the desert where nothing grows. There's no wood left. So this guy had to go out, at least he guessed, a few miles to gather the wood, to gather stuff, because everybody else has already been gathering the easy stuff. That was easy. That was stuff you do on, you know, every day of the week. This is the hard day. But he argued the man waited till Shabbat to do it. He could have done it any day of the week. He waited till Shabbat to do it. That was his argument. Right or wrong, I don't know. It's just a simple story. Yeah, no complications, right? Nothing else to do. Any other questions or comments about Shavuot or Shabbat or how the cycle of Shavuot and Jubilee are tied together? The process of freedom, the process of we are now counted and we are in this group. Which is how Ruth got in, it's how we get in, it's how all the Jews got in, every guy the same exact way. This process of, I'm throwing my hat in the ring too. I want that spirit also. I want that life also. And so, you get counted. You're included too. You're no longer a slave. No longer in sin. No longer in death. You're now in life. Any questions or comments? Thank you for your time. Have a good rest of your high day. Shabbat shalom. Mighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for this holy day, our day of rest, our day of time to worship and praise you. Father, grant us peace and understanding to listen to your voice and follow where you lead us, that we will grant and choose life, grant life to friends and family and loved ones, freedom to all those who we can. Father, grant us your life and your strength, that you may keep us as your own possession. May we always be restored to you and look forward to that day. We praise and trust you, Father, and ask your blessing. In Yeshua's name, amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.